Our own Marcia Farmer has done a lot of work documenting our church's history. And I love that, by the way. I love history. I love church history. And I love our church's history. For those of you who don't know, our church was founded on Christmas Day in 1856. Anyway, one of the things that Marcia did was put together a collage of the church's pastors. And I hope we're going to be able to take a look at this for just a moment. Think about the lives of these men and their families. Where did they move from to lead our church? What challenges did they face here? Why did they leave when they did? What were the big issues that faced the church during the days in which they pastored here? I've always thought, by the way, that there ought to be a before and after picture of pastors. Think about American history. During the time that the men who pastored our church served here, our church was doing ministry. The Civil War raged. Slavery was an accepted institution during the first decade of our church's existence. The church was just 3 years old when Charles Darwin published his Origin of Species in 1859, kickstarting the rise of the evolutionary philosophy that would attack evangelicalism up to this very moment. These pastors were involved in an up-close and personal way with the so-called Wild West. Jesse James, you likely know, was a member of this church. When I tell people that, I'm always quick to remind them I had absolutely nothing to do with his discipleship. But imagine what it would be like pastoring a church with outlaws as members. Well, look around. I know what that's like. You're all familiar with the name Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the great British pastor. Look at this picture for a moment. The first 13 men shown here pastored our church while Spurgeon pastored the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London. Now, fast forward just a bit. The church lived through the fundamentalist-modernist controversy, which pitted Orthodox Christianity with the more liberal offshoot that focused not on biblical doctrine, but rather experience. The modernists believed that God revealed himself through the progress of history, leading to a very optimistic worldview that saw humankind as being inherently good, and the movement of history was towards seeing the fulfillment of the kingdom of God on earth, and many of them believed the kingdom would come in the not too distant future. And the church, this church, survived all of that. The church ministered through prohibition and women's suffrage. They survived World Wars I and II, the chaos of Vietnam, the sexual revolution of the 1960s, the Jesus movement of the 1970s, and on and on and on. Here's my point in all of this. I don't know if anyone here became a part of our church during Albert Baker's tenure. I suspect at this point, Glenn Muncy would have been the first pastor anyone in our church today would have known personally. I'm not going to do it, but I think it would be fun to ask who became a part of our church during the Glenn Muncy era, and then ask about the Warner Wilson years, the William Wade era, the Phil Jett time frame, and then ask who joined while Ledford Carey was pastor here, or Paul Berkeley, or Sid Beiler, or Ron Robinson, or the time with the really handsome and much younger pastor pictured in the bottom right. To the point, this is an unbelievable foundation. I look at this picture and I think about all the prayer and the effort and the energy and the money that it has taken to keep this church going so that we could be who we are today. So, to whom do we owe a great debt of gratitude? Just the pastors who have been your pastors during your time here? No. The foundation for ministry here was laid by all of these men and the men who, in fact, preceded them. We owe a debt of gratitude to all the members of our church from Christmas Day of 1856 forward. We are building on the foundation they laid. And Paul, in his first letter to the church at Corinth, is going to remind the people about how important the foundation really is. And even as we consider our own church and just the part this church has played in the gospel drama all these years, we must remember the countless believers who comprise the redeemed of all the ages that have gone before us. It is, in fact, an overwhelming legacy we are to steward and an unbelievably firm foundation we are to protect and build upon. So, let's not mess it up. Amen? Called to be saints together, we're continuing in our verse-by-verse study through the book of 1 Corinthians, and we find ourselves in the third chapter, beginning with the 10th verse. And if you're able, I'll invite you to stand, please, for the reading of God's Word. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning with verse 10. According to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation, and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. Thank you so very much. You may be seated. I really don't believe in coincidence at all. In fact, the timing of today's sermon is pretty cool. We're going to be talking about work, as in our work for Christ. And tomorrow is Labor Day, where we celebrate work. I want you to know I couldn't have planned that had my life depended on it. So we have a detour this morning and then three main points. First of all, the detour. Don't miss the metaphors and the grace. Don't miss the metaphors and the grace. I want to remind us of two things at this point in this brief detour: metaphors and grace. Paul is going to extensively use metaphors during the next several verses to contrast various things. We talked about these for just a little bit last time we were together. Let me remind you of the main metaphors that he, in fact, mentions. First of all, he'll talk about babies and adults, and then he'll talk about planting and watering, foundations and buildings, servants and stewards, kings and paupers, and finally, when we get to chapter 4, beginning with verse 14, he's going to talk about fathers and children. I think that's a really helpful way to look at these things. Metaphors have the ability to explain something or offer information, but also to deal with things in a deeper way, and perhaps we might say, hammer home a point. For example, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 4, Paul could have just said, look, you guys are not where you need to be spiritually. And that would have been totally true, and it would have been completely accurate. But it would not have packed the punch like what he said actually did. Remember what he said? He said, I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you were not ready for it. In fact, you're still not ready for it. Metaphors grip us. They hit us in a different kind of way. So don't miss the metaphors. They're important. They're going to be powerful. But also, don't miss the grace. Don't miss the grace. Paul begins verse 10 of chapter 3 by saying, according to the grace of God given to me. I can't tell you how important that brief phrase actually is. If Jesus is the foundation of the Christian faith, and he is, and we'll see that again in just a moment, then grace is the foundation for Paul's leadership within the Christian faith. Paul was not a leader because he was well-educated. He wasn't a leader because he was intelligent. He wasn't a leader because he had oratorical skills or powers of persuasion that lifted him far above the rest of the crowd. He was made a leader of the Christian faith according to, here it is, the grace of God. Now, what does that say to you and me? It says that God's grace is always more important than man's ability. It says that experiencing God's grace is always a prerequisite for empowerment to do God's will. Grace is the big deal. Grace is the big deal. Aptitude, ability, not nearly as much. If God chooses you to do something, I promise God will equip you to do it. So don't miss the grace. In all of our doing as believers, recognize this is an enterprise of grace. The church, above all, is supposed to be a place of grace. The Christian home is supposed to be a place of grace. Our speech is to be seasoned with grace. Do you get the picture? Remember, Jesus did not say, "They will know you by your influence." He said, "They'll know you by your love." And that kind of love should be demonstrated in direct proportion to the grace that's been given. So don't miss the metaphors and the grace. Three main things this morning. First of all, the Christian faith is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ. The Christian faith is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ. Verse 10 and 11, "According to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it, for no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." The Christian faith is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ. And you say, "Ken, we're in church on a Sunday morning. It's a holiday weekend, man." We know that. If we didn't know that, we'd be somewhere else. I know that. But the truth is, just as important as it is for Paul to have said that to the church at Corinth, it's important for me to say that to the church at Kearney. We always need to remind ourselves what this is really all about. It's about Jesus. He's the foundation. Paul, by the way, is not afraid to posit his opinion that his role is that of an expert in terms of building. In verse 9, he's moved to an architectural metaphor from an agricultural one. He's moved to building from planting, and he knows the plan of God for the building of his church. Paul gets that, and Paul is not afraid to tell those who will listen he's an expert at doing that very thing. He notes that what he does is like a skilled master builder. He knows the material that he's supposed to use, and he knows, in fact, how he's supposed to use it. Let me say something important about this idea of being an expert, of knowing our stuff. I know there are a lot of complexities in life. That reality does not escape me. Please understand that. I know that there are certainly complexities within our faith. There are, in fact, questions that are not easily answered, and there are challenges that are not easily rectified. But it is not helpful. In fact, I would say it's never helpful to be dismissive of those complexities and of those queries. Let me be quick to say there are some things that we or I may not readily have the answer to. But that does not mean we shouldn't consider how to go about finding the answer. There are some areas of life, you guys know this, there are some areas of life, and in fact, there are some areas of theology about which we've not all studied. It's complicated. There are complexities to life. There are complexities to theology, but that doesn't mean that we can be dismissive of the questions related to those issues. If we're going to be the alternative to the secularist, humanist, postmodern, post-Christian, dare I say, messed up culture of today, we need to have something positive to offer to counter all of those godless philosophies. Well, certainly what we believe takes faith. I know that. I get that. You do too. And faith is, in the most ultimate sense, a gift from God. The truth is, brothers and sisters, there is a lot of evidence. There's a lot of hard facts to reinforce that which we believe. But ultimately, it takes faith. After all, we believe a dead carpenter got up and walked. It takes faith. But having faith doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive to answer the hard questions. Again, I realize there are some things that are impossible to fully grasp or fully understand or explain. I know that within Scripture, there are some things that are, in fact, mystery, and they're held in theological tension. For example, if God is a good God, which we believe He is, then people often ask the question, why does He allow evil in the world? I'm sure nobody's ever asked you that. Now, there are a lot of angles that we can take to answer that. But the truth of the matter is, we might say that's a bit of a complicated question. If God is a good God, why does He allow evil in the world? If you come back next week, I'll tell you. The truth is, I think there is an answer. But frankly, it's not an answer with which a lot of people will find contentment. Or how could God create the whole world and everything else in it in just 6 days? Ken, are you kidding me? Now, granted, that question often comes from the very same people who do believe that a dead carpenter got up and walked. I would say, if He can do one, I'm pretty sure He can do the other. But we should not be afraid of or shy away from those kinds of questions and a whole lot more. And as an aside, if we are afraid or if we do shy away from those, we will further alienate the kids who have grown up among us. Among the statistical data that we recognize today, it demonstrates a lot of younger people, even those who have grown up in the church, even a conservative Bible-believing church like this one, end up on the opposite end of the spectrum faith-wise from where they started. Now, I think there are a lot of reasons for that, frankly. Some of it is perhaps immaturity. You know how this works if you've raised children. If you, as the dad, say that the sky is blue, your kid's going to say it's green, because you can't agree with dad. And so a lot of kids kind of see what mom and dad have believed, and they think, man, I can't deal with that right now. I've got to go out and find myself. I would never want to find myself. I'm scared to death of what I would find. Aren't you? So sometimes it's immaturity. Some of it is that they've not been in situations previously where they've had to think these things through for themselves without family support or without a community of faith. Some of it is because they want to taste what the world has to offer. And they know that if they go that direction, at some level, they've got to leave behind the stuff that they were taught, in many cases, from childhood. And some of it is because at a young age, let's face it, please don't take offense, but we all thought we knew more than we really did. Can I get a witness? Don't lie in church, people. You know I'm talking about how it works. I say to young pastors, I talk about things with young pastors all the time, and they say, well, Ken, nobody in my church would ever. Okay, man, you call me in 20 years. Here's my cell. Or young parents, my children will never. Okay, call me in 20 years. So Paul was an expert builder when it came to the things of faith. We see from 1 Corinthians 2:2 that Paul had laid the doctrinal foundation for the church by knowing nothing except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Jesus and His substitutionary death on the cross and His resurrection, that's the foundation. That is the foundation for what Paul will in turn be building. And listen, that's the foundation upon which every church ought to still be built. And listen, certainly, It is the foundation upon which this church has been built. It's easy, though, I'm afraid, for the foundation and even the mission of the church to be hijacked. It's happening all around us. In an attempt to pacify the culture, a lot of churches are giving in and leaving the moorings of their doctrinal distinctives. And we, brothers and sisters, I'm talking to all of us, we must always be on guard that we collectively never allow that to happen. We believe what we believe. And, right? We believe what we believe. And nothing should ever change that. Not personalities, not politics, not politics, and not even a pandemic. We're not here, let me be really clear, we're not here to indoctrinate anybody into any particular ideology apart from the Christian faith as taught in the New Testament. Everything else, every other group, every other ideology is secondary to the foundation of our belief in and our work for Christ. The foundation has to be right if the building is going to be right. Juan Rodriguez notes in an article from January of 2019 that the original two levels of the Tower of Pisa, known, of course, as the Leaning Tower of Pisa, didn't lean at all. But it began to move when construction started on the third level and beyond in 1178. Now, there's an awful lot of fascinating information about the structure itself. Suffice it to say, experts have not agreed for years about the cause of the leaning. Even they've debated whether or not it might have been built, designed to actually lean. Here's what we know for sure. The foundation for the Tower of Pisa was laid in 1173. It was constructed mostly of marble and lime. The tower was built in a circular ditch, ready for this? About 5 feet deep. Over ground consisting of clay, fine sand, and shells. Clay, fine sand, shells. 5 feet deep. Well, I'm not a builder, but see, the problem is not the wind or the elements, or the fragile masonry. The challenge to the structure is the foundation. The most important thing in the entire building is the foundation. And listen, that is true of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and that is true of the Christian faith as a whole, and that is true of your life and my life too. So the Christian faith is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ. Secondly, the Christian faith is a faith of grace, but it leads to works. The Christian faith is a faith of grace, but it leads to works. Verses 12 and 13. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. The Christian faith is a faith of grace, but it leads to works. We understand, I think anyway, as much as mere mortals can, what Paul says in Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, remember, for it is by grace you've been saved through faith, and this not of yourselves, it's a gift of God, not of works, so that no one can boast. You guys remember that. You know what that means. We are, after all, as a church, as redeemed people, we are a place of grace. We get that. Now, the truth is, I could say a whole lot about grace. We could talk for weeks and weeks and months, in fact, years and decades about grace. But the truth is, I could talk about all of that and probably never say anything about grace that you've not heard before. But I love what Steve Brown has so often said, and that is this. He said, if we try to qualify it or quantify it, it's not grace. It's not grace. In other words, it stands on its own. Don't try to add to it. Don't try to explain it away. Don't try to take anything from it. The fact, listen, it doesn't have to make complete sense for us for it to be totally true. The fact that we are fully forgiven after being at enmity with God is a demonstration that we can't fully comprehend what grace is all about anyway. We were all totally hostile to God in our spiritual orientation, and Jesus came to die in our place, thus extending God's forgiveness to all. That doesn't make any sense. Except by grace. In 3:12, Paul mentions gold and silver and precious stones. We know from 1 Chronicles 29, these were things used in the building of Solomon's temple. Paul might have had that in mind. He might have had some other structures in mind as well. These were things that were used in that day. Here Paul uses them as imagery for what survives ultimate judgment. In other words, it matters what materials one uses to build. So gold, silver, precious stones are, in a sense, seen in contrast, potentially, to wood, hay, and straw. The idea here is this, as many would posit. What Christians do, that is, the action of believers, so yes, that would be works. What Christians do, the action of believers in obedience to Christ, is rewarded. Works done in the power of the flesh or things of disobedience will not be. Therefore, as many scholars would say, using the right materials is symbolic of faithfulness to Paul's God-given duties as a builder of God's church. In other words, it's not just what we do, but it's the heart behind what we're doing that matters too. And again, remember, we're not talking about a literal building. We're talking about God's people. There's long been a tension you recognize between faith and works or grace and works among followers of Jesus. I don't think, for the record, I don't think it's an either-or kind of scenario. Let me explain. Dr. Dale Allen was my Bible professor at Missouri Baptist University in St. Louis. In fact, I believe it was just last year that Dr. Allen went home to be with Christ. But he understood and taught that we are, in fact, saved by grace through faith. He understood, as we understand, that works won't save anyone, no question about it. Nobody's saying that they will. But he also understood and taught, are you ready for this? That once we are saved, we're called to live like it. Once we're saved, we're called to live like it. So Dr. Allen used to say it this way, faith alone saves, but faith that saves is never alone. That was worth the price of admission this morning. So the Christian faith is built on the foundation of Jesus. The Christian faith is a faith of grace, but it leads to works. Thirdly and finally, the Christian future includes reward and loss. The Christian future includes reward and loss. Verse 14 and following. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. We're told that even in antiquity, ancient buildings were required to undergo an inspection of sorts. There would be a contract stating when the inspection would actually occur. Paul uses the very same language that was commonly used to refer to this particular building inspection. He said, the day will disclose it. In other words, in the ancient world, on that day, that particular day, it would be clear what materials were actually used because the building would be inspected. what the building was really made of would be shown. You see where Paul is going with this. And now Paul uses this phrase, the day, in an eschatological sense, implying there will be a day, capital D, a day of inspection when God himself would examine how his people have been building. Were they using the materials of which he approved? Were they serving him, and were they building the right way? Was everything being built on the foundation of Christ? So there's possibility for reward, and there's possibility for loss. Not loss of salvation, mind you, but loss of reward. The CSB Study Bible points out, and I quote, In the ancient world, a reward was granted to those who constructed the building on time, within budget, and according to specifications. And Paul warned those who built carelessly that they would suffer loss. I'm afraid a lot of spiritual movements are building on the wrong foundation. I'm afraid a lot of churches are building on the wrong foundation. In fact, I'm afraid a lot of Christians are building their lives on the wrong foundation. I'm afraid that a lot of Christians spend a lot of time and effort and energy on the wrong things, not building the right things, running a race, but not always running the right way, or not maybe even running the right race. In his work, Thinking and Acting Like a Christian, Bruce Lockerbie writes the following. The world-class female runner was invited to compete in a road race in Connecticut. On the morning of the race, she drove from New York City following the directions, or so she thought, given to her over the telephone. So this is pre-Siri, obviously. She got lost, stopped at a gas station, and asked for help. She knew the race started in the parking lot of a shopping mall. The gas station attendant also knew of such a race scheduled just up the road, and he directed her to go to that place. When she arrived, she was so relieved to find the parking lot. Just a modest number of runners had gathered there preparing to run the race. Not nearly as many as she had anticipated, an easier race than she had been led to expect. She hurried over to the registration desk. She announced herself, and she was surprised by the race officials' excitement at having such a renowned athlete show up for their race. They didn't have a record of her entry, but if she would hurry and put on the number, she could make it just before the gun would go off, signaling the beginning of the race. She ran and naturally won easily, some 4 minutes ahead of the first male runner who finished in second place. Only after the race, when there was no envelope containing her prize money, did she confirm the event she'd run was not the race to which she had been invited. That race was being held several miles farther up the road in another town. She had gone to the wrong starting line, run the wrong race, and missed her chance to win a prize. That's a great lesson for a runner, but an even greater lesson for a Christian.